The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us, a personal finance show on money, investing, the economy, and why they matter. I'm your host, David Stein, and today is episode 27. It's titled, What is the Right Price? Before we get into today's episode, I want to welcome those listeners that might be new and let you know that we're 27 episodes in, and some people have listened to all 27 or 26 in one weekend or over several weeks. That might not be you, and I've done something on the homepage of my website, moneyfortherestofus.net. There you can browse by topic and themes, and you can choose a particular theme. And it'll take you to a page that'll list three or four episodes that cover that theme. It'll also have some articles that also do that. Even if you've listened to all the episodes, this is kind of a way to go back if you want to rehear and do it in a thematic approach. So, episode 27, what is the right price? And in today's topic, let me start with an experience. I mentioned a few episodes ago I was in Park City with my family. And there in Park City, there's a bookstore I really like. It's called Dolly's Bookstore. And I like it because it's very, very homey feeling. The wood, the floors are hardwood, the shelves are wood, and they're arranged in sort of nooks. So it feels very, very homey as you sit there and browse. You feel kind of sheltered. Plus, they have this really cool, fluffy cat. And so when we go to Park City, we like to go to the bookstore. But it's probably been, I don't remember the last time I actually bought a hardbound book at a bookstore. I usually buy them used online, buy them from Amazon. But I like Dolly's Bookstore, and I wanted to support their business. So I decided I'm going to buy a book. And I'd recently read the Kindle sample of Steven Pinker's book. It's a book on writing called A Sense of Style. And I thought, that'd be a good book to buy. And I found it on the shelf. It was $27.95. And it was not a very thick book. I had my phone and looked it up. Well, what does it cost on Amazon? $16.77 for the same hard book on Amazon. So at an $11 premium. And the ebook was about $12.99, which is pricey for an ebook, but also 45% less than the hardbound book. And I looked at the book, I held it in my hand, I thought, this Pinker's nice book, but not very thick. I feel like if I paid $27.95, I might be overpaying. And I'd have a lot more at risk. What if I didn't like the book? And then I paid that much. So I put it back on the shelf. And hemmed and hawed and thought about it. And I realized, well, one way I thought about it is, well, yeah, maybe look at it like I'm paying $17 for the book and $10.95 for the entertainment at shopping at Dolly's. And that would be one way to look at it, sort of break it down into the entertainment component of shopping, because Amazon online shopping isn't terribly entertaining, but in a bookstore with a fluffy cat, that could be entertaining. But I still felt like I was overpaying. Yet later that night, my daughter and I would go eat at a Vietnamese restaurant, pay more than $27.95 to eat there, and it didn't feel like I was overpaying. Here's what I was suffering from, and it's something we all suffer from. It's called anchoring and mental accounting. Anchoring is a concept in behavioral finance where we have what's called a reference price, something that sort of anchors our view of what things should cost. In my case, 10 years ago, paying $20, $25 for a hardbound book seem okay, because that's what books cost. Now with ebooks, which I tend to prefer ebooks because I can highlight passages without feeling like I'm defacing the page. I can store hundreds of books on my Kindle or my iPad, and I can carry them with me. I can do keyword searches, so I find them much more convenient. But sometimes it's just, it feels like you want to hold a real book and turn real pages. But my anchor price for a book is $10. So now when I pay more than that, it seems like I'm overpaying, and that's what's called anchoring. The other concept in behavioral economics is called mental accounting. And we do this all the time. We have certain categories where we might have certain anchor prices, but that's one mental account. For example, eating out at a restaurant, in my mind, $27.95 at a sit-down restaurant where you're paying for the service, you're paying for the atmosphere, you're paying to eat off of glass china plates, silverware, that seems like a reasonable price. Yeah, it's more than paying what you would pay if you did carry out, but it was less. Well, it was more than that, but my mental count, $30 for a sit-down dinner at a decent restaurant, is a reasonable price to pay. Yet, as I go to Molly's and think about paying this $27.95, different mental count, different price, my anchor price for books. The problem was solved by my daughter, though. She found a book that she wanted. It was called 21st Century Herbs. It was a modern encyclopedia of herbs, or as she called it, herbs. And it pointed out to me that you can't actually say herbs for herbs. I don't know if they say that in the UK, but the dictionary at least said that was an appropriate pronunciation. So she just likes to gall me by saying herbs. So she found a herb book, $35. It was hardback, but it was thick and heavy and 500 pages with glossy photos. And it was presented really, really nice on the page. You open it up and kind of on two page, it would feature one herb or herb and how it can use. And it was a cool book. And I looked up the price on Amazon, $26.03. So there was still a premium to pay for the book at Dolly's. It was superior to the ebook. And at the end, we bought the book and we felt good about it. Now, that entertainment premium was also there. There was a $9 entertainment premium for that supported Dolly's. And I understand why Dolly's charges $27.95 for a book or $35. Rent in Park City is expensive on Main Street. And particularly, it's a great location because it's right behind a chocolate store. Chocolate and books, what a great combination. And they have workers to pay. This is not a big store. It's a small store. And so there's workers that curate this collection of books because it has classics, it has new releases, hardback and paperback books. And it's a great bookstore because I like to go to physical bookstores because it just gives me, I run into books I hadn't thought of or I hadn't seen before, and just the juxtapositions of different types of books. There's a cat to feed at the store. The fluffy cat needs cat food. There's power bills to pay. There's a premium to physical bookstore. And so I should be comfortable paying an entertainment premium for being there. I felt better doing it with a $35 book because it was a $9 entertainment premium, pretty close to $11 for the $27.95 book, but it was only 25% of the herb book. And the entertainment premium was close to 40% for the writing book. And so that's an example of mental accounting where the premium paid was a smaller percentage. So it felt like I was paying less. Behavioral economics is, and I referred to it last week in a book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. And Richard Thaler was another researcher in behavioral economics, and they researched sort of these mental games that we play with pricing decisions and in our financial life. Anchoring is an example of that. Mental accounting is another example of that. Another aspect of mental accounting is a number of years ago, my son and I went to New York, and I used to go to New York a couple times a year, but I brought him with me, and he wanted to go see a Broadway show. We were going to go see Spamalot. Great show. I pre-ordered the tickets. They were probably $100 a piece, which is a lot. And they had them sent to me. We showed up in New York. We were there a couple days and decided, well, it's our day. It's Friday. We need to go to the show. I pull out the ticket, and the date was for the day before, Thursday. We missed it. Now what do you do? Well, we went down to the theater, and I showed him my ticket that expired, and just there was that very, very small hope that maybe they would let us in. No, the gentleman says, you're going to have to buy another ticket. Well, how much are those? $150 a piece. And what do you do? I bought the ticket. So now we have $250 per ticket to go see Spamalot because I had to buy them twice. That felt like I was overpaying. Yet here's something interesting with behavioral economics. If I had actually lost $100 or $200, and as opposed to having missed the ticket, it wouldn't have felt so bad. In other words, it's another example of mental accounting. Losing money is one thing. So if I'd gone to the movie theater and wanted to buy a ticket to go to the movie theater, but I lost my $10 that I was going to use to pay and had to use another $10 to buy a movie ticket, it wouldn't have felt so bad because it was still only $10 associated with the movie ticket. In the case of Spamalot, I now had $250 riding on this one Broadway show, and it dang well better be good because I've got so much vested in it. Monetarily, it's the same thing. It's still $250, but now it's tied to the mental account of entertainment. And this episode, and it was a good show. I'm not sure it was worth $250 per ticket, but my son enjoyed it, and it was a good experience. Here's a question for you. Is it better to pay $500 for a weekend in New York City, or is it better to take that $500 and buy a new iPhone 6? Now, better in terms of which will make you happier. There's a recent study that James Hamblin pointed out in Atlantic Magazine, and it was a study by Thomas Gilovich, Matthew Killingsworth, and Amit Kumar. Their behavioral finance, they study the brain. And it was an article in, James Hamblin was writing about it, but it was in the journal Psychological Science. And they asked this question, what's better to what will make you happier, buying a thing or buying an experience? It turns out that the experience makes us happy. And here's a quote by James Hamblin. Quote, essentially, when you can't live in the moment, they say, it's best to live in anticipation of an experience. Experiential purchases like trips, concerts, movies, etc., tend to trump material purchase because the utility of buying anything really starts accruing before you buy it. For my son, going to Spamalot, he was very, very happy because you could look forward to it. There's looking forward to experiences actually brings us pleasure. Looking forward, I ordered an iPhone 6. It's not going to be here for 30 days. That delay in waiting for an iPhone, because I've already touched that, I know exactly what it's like, doesn't really make me happy. As opposed to a trip that we're taking in January to Phoenix, where it'll be nice and sunny, as opposed to cold and snowy in Idaho, that I'm willing to wait for, and it makes me happy. And so always better to buy experiences than to purchase things. Let me pause here to share some words from this week's sponsors.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. In my professional life, I've seen how important it is to have quality candidates to interview so we could find the right hire. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/David. That's linkedin.com/David to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Quick math, the less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. With everything seeming to get more expensive these days, you need to find proven ways to cut cost and boost performance at the same time. And NetSuite can help with that. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/David. That's netsuite.com/David. netsuite.com/David.
Let's revisit this concept of anchor prices. One way to avoid overpaying for something is not have a reference point in mind in terms of what it should cost. Here's an example. I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, and when I, in my early 40s, I decided I want to get an executive physical because I'm kind of getting middle age. I want to make sure that there's nothing lurking that I'm not aware of. So we went down to Phoenix to the Mayo Clinic, and they spent an entire day doing diagnostics. And we had kind of the one doctor that was kind of quarterback, and at the end of the day, we met with him, and he pointed out, and I'll say he pointed out with a great sense of glee, and that I had a very rare heart condition that would potentially need surgery at some point. And when I say glee, you remind me of the character House on the TV show, where he literally said, I would never have thought that was wrong with you. And I'm sitting there, what? I've never heard of this disease. What is this? And explain it to me. But as a result, I have a heart condition, and potentially, and it would be a risky surgery if I needed it. And so every 2 years, I go to the Cleveland Clinic to have them check out my heart. And there's no symptoms at all. So, I mean, I'm perfectly fine. So, not that you're worried about it. So, I'm fine. Except, potentially, I'll need a surgery. And so, I go, and I just did this a few weeks ago. I went to Cleveland Clinic. And I chose Cleveland Clinic because this is such... Here's my philosophy on medical care. If possible, if you have some risky surgery that not many people have done, go to the place where they've done the most of them, because they're the ones that are learning the most. And not every, I recognize not everybody can do that. But in this case, I am willing to go to the Cleveland Clinic and have them check out my heart. And so you go through the diagnostics, and then I'm there in the waiting room, or actually in the examining room, waiting for the doctor and the fellow to come in and tell me what the status is. And if you've been there, it's a little nerve-wracking because you don't, I mean, things could have turned for the worst. They came in, they told me I was fine, and now I'm back home in Idaho waiting for the bill. I can tell you, it doesn't matter what the bill's going to be because now I have the peace of mind that I'm okay. Cleveland Clinic could charge as much as they want. Now, I have a high deductible insurance plan, so I mean, I'm paying out of pocket for whatever it is. But there isn't a reference point because it's a unique experience. For completely unique experiences, in this case, not necessarily a good unique experience, but one that I'm willing to pay for my health, there is no anchor price, a reference point. Think about going to, I used to work with colleges, and I would invest money for colleges, a lot of liberal arts private schools that charge $40,000, $50,000 per year. Think about the price of Harvard or Yale or some of these other schools. In their case, it is a unique experience. We talk about how tuition rates have gone up significantly, but one little secret for colleges, particularly private schools, is the tuition is just the sticker price. It's a list price. They're heavily discounting off that depending on the student. So everybody sort of pays a different price, but because it's a unique experience, we're willing to pay more. And if you get a discount because you get a scholarship, and most people get some type of financial aid, it lowers the price, so then it doesn't feel so bad. Another example is I recently got my bill from my accountant. I don't have an anchor price for what my accountant should charge me. I know if I could pay $50 for a software program to do it, but my taxes are so complicated, it doesn't work for me anymore. And so I go to an accountant, and we don't even talk about what the bill's going to be. He just sends me a bill after he does his accounting. In this case, I think it was a $1,600 bill. I got a $100 discount because I did refer a client to him this year, $1,600. I have no idea he did my taxes. I got a refund, which was a surprise because I pay all estimated taxes, so I pay too much in estimated taxes. So that lessened the blow. But for things where there isn't really a reference price, particularly for information content, he's providing a service. You don't usually price shop for accounting services. You go because of their experience, and because I go to him because he's a friend, and he could pretty much charge what he wanted, and I probably would pay it because I don't really have a reference price. Now, I did in this case. I went back to a friend back in Ohio and asked, "Well, what do you pay for your accountant?" $600. Well, I don't know how good his accountant is. So it makes it very, very challenging. That's one of the issues with financial advice or an intangible. Why pay 1% for somebody to manage your money? Is that a good price? I used to manage money. And I can tell you, when I first started back in 95, I had clients that we were paying that paid us $8,000. I'd say it was like a $30 million college foundation, $8,000. And I, at one point, I tripled the fee to $24,000. And how could I justify that? Well, because there wasn't a reference price, and I was getting paid based on what my percent of the revenue. And so I felt like I deserved a raise. And they were paying managers 1%, and I was making probably making 0.06 or 0.08%, so very, very small. And so that was kind of a reference. It was a reference to me. They're making, the managers that are picking stocks are making a lot more money than me that's working with the committee doing the asset allocation, the policy. And at the end of the day, here's the thing about investing. It's the asset allocation over the long term that drives performance, not whether some stock manager is holding IBM or Apple. It has a small impact, but not as much impact as how much we have in stocks, how much in bonds, how much in alternative investments such as private capital, et cetera. So I could justify tripling the fee. And when we get a new client, it would be twice as much as that, not $24,000. Then we raised our fees to $50,000, then $100,000. And that's why you need to be careful with financial advice, because there isn't really any reference point, because it's an information product. You're providing in some ways, what investment advisors provide is hope to some extent, but also just that peace of mind and that confidence. What price do you put on that? Now, there's one more aspect of price and what is the right price that economists are really, really worried about right now, and that's deflation. Falling prices is what deflation is. And there's even mental sort of gymnastics that we do regarding falling prices. We're looking to take a trip next year back to overseas. I haven't bought the tickets yet because I know the price of oil has fallen, and I've seen it fall 20%, yet it's not reflected in ticket prices. I expect airline ticket prices to fall. The concern regarding deflation that worries economists is if we get in, consumers get in the habit of waiting for prices to fall before we buy. And that's where you can get into a very much a deflationary spiral, because deflation tends to occur during a period where there's excess capacity, where there's high unemployment, and so people are unwilling to spend. And so businesses start to lower prices in order to spur demand. But if consumers start to wait for prices to fall, then they're less likely to buy. And let's get back to these reference prices. Think about computers and electronics. We're sort of used to the prices not going up. This year's iPhone should be priced very close to the one 2 years ago, yet it's so much better. And so on a quality-adjusted basis, it's actually dropped in price. Now, if baskets of good are falling in price, not because they're getting better, but because businesses are lowering prices in order to spur demand, and we get into the habit of waiting for – we don't want to buy now because it could be cheaper in tomorrow or next week – that is what concerns economists and government officials and central banks about deflation. So there is a behavioral aspect to inflation and deflation where, again, we have reference points and anchor prices. If we think prices are going to go up, we act one way. If we think they're going to go down, we act another way. One other aspect of these mental games we play with pricing is something Richard Thaler has done research on called the endowment effect. LaPrill and I have been wanting to buy an old Airstream trailer or some one of these cool trailers from the 50s or 60s. And as you drive all around Idaho, everyone seems to go out in the country and there are trailers in people's yards that haven't moved in years. And invariably, when you go and ask them, is the trailer for sale? They'll say no. And if you try to get them to name a price, it'll be very, very high. There is an aspect called the endowment effect. When we own something, the value of that tends to be much greater than it would be if we didn't own it. And because we use it, we have some emotional attachment to it. And so often it's hard to part with it. And so we value it more. There's an endowment effect. Traders, though, it's a trader in campers, don't have that because in their case, the trailer is to be traded. It's in a different mental account. It's not something to be used. The endowment effect affects things that we use. And so we are unwilling to part with them. And whereas somebody trying to buy it wants to pay a lot less. They want to pay a fair price, but oftentimes that endowment effect means the price that we want is much higher than really what it ought to be. So These are all examples of the behavioral aspects of pricing. What is the right price? The right price depends. It depends on our reference point. It depends on our mental account. It depends on the endowment effect. It depends on where we think prices are going to be, whether they're rising or falling. These are all aspects. It depends on how unique the experience is and whether we're willing to pay for it. All these impact the price. And there isn't ever a right price. It always, always depends. Now, what we can do to help us is to recognize it. Recognize when we have mental accounts and how it really doesn't really make sense. If we can step back and try to be a little more logical in terms of why we feel like we do about prices, sometimes we can make it through. It's just as I did at the bookstore. I knew why I felt like I was overpaying. I knew I could talk about the entertainment premium, but at the end of the day, I found a way to support the bookstore by actually paying more than I would have if I'd bought the cheaper book, but I felt better about it. That's episode 27, What is the Right Price? You can get show notes for this episode, including links to a number of the articles that I referenced at moneyfortherestofus.net. That's also where you can sign up for my insider's guide, where I will email you those show notes each week. Also in the email, I share things that didn't make it into the show. I answer listeners' questions, and it's sort of a forum, an ongoing kind of dialogue. That's at moneyfortherestofus.net. You can email me with questions or suggestions for show topics at jd@jdavidstein.com. Everything I've shared with you on this episode is for general education only. I have not considered your specific risk profile. I have not provided investment advice, simply education on money, investing, the economy. Next week, episode 28.